Hello and welcome to Behind the Buyouts, the deals podcast where we sit down with private equity and venture capital pros and entrepreneurs and talk about their deals. My name is Steve Gelsey, senior writer for The Deal and the host of this podcast. Today, we're welcoming Steve Pearson, managing partner at Lovell Minnick Partners, the Philadelphia-based private equity firm that focuses on the financial sector. Welcome, Steve. Always good to meet another Steve.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be here. I appreciate it.
So before we get into your specific deals that you want to talk about at the firm, there are a couple of macro trends out there in private equity around financial technology or fintech, as well as insurance technology, also called insurtech, in terms of larger volumes of deals and more M&A players in the space. Your career has spanned both big corporate banks as well as private equity firms. Why the increase in focus and capital around this space?
Sure. Yeah, great question, Steve. So I think what we've seen across the financial technology landscape is an evolution from what I would say used to be more of a focus on the corporate side of financial technology, or the picks and shovels side of the business, if you will. And of late, what's gotten a lot more visibility in the last 5+ years has been many more of the retail focused deals in financial technology. You've certainly seen smaller players that have been funded, primarily venture capital funded on the West Coast historically, that have been nipping at the heels of the big branded institutions, both on the insurance side as well as on the banking side. And it's that I'd say that pressure from the competition of these small, more nimble players, and in some cases more lightly regulated. I mean, typically the space that we're in is a heavily regulated space. I think those smaller players have driven the larger shops to a recognition that their clients are demanding, very quick, accessible, easy to use, nice GUIs, et cetera, in terms of interacting with their clients. And that seems to have really accelerated in the last 5+ years.
So it's kind of like the bigger organizations haven't been able to innovate. They've been focusing more on regulation, right? So that leaves the smaller players, the more nimble players, to be a little bit more maybe inventive and to grow more quickly. I guess we've seen that in a lot of places in the economy.
I think that's very fair. I mean, if you back up to post the financial crisis and think about many of the large firms coming out of the crisis post 2008-2009, very focused on making sure that first and foremost, they did what their regulators wanted them to do, that they were rebuilding capital, that they were making sure that they had a very stable balance sheet, and certainly the smaller players that were starting with a white sheet of paper, if you will, were not focused on those things. They were focused on servicing clients and servicing them in a very technologically enabled way. That's a relatively recent development, though, so just in the past decade. So I think what the larger guys have needed to do is either catch up or hire from, or in many cases acquire or partner, with these smaller, more tech-enabled firms.
Right. So how does Lovell Minnick fit into all this? Do you consider yourselves a financial private equity firm or a technology focused investor? In other words, because your firm's been specializing in the financial services sector for more than 20 years, it's adapted its strategy along with the technological evolution of the industry. So talk about some of those trends and how Lovell Minnick fits into that mix.
Sure. Yeah. So certainly if you go back, and this would have been the case, if you think back to 20 years that you just referenced to, 99, 2000, when the business of Lovell Minnick was first built inside the Putnam Lovell banking franchise, at that time, financial technology really was probably limited to the e-brokers, if you will. So it's pretty narrow, certain segments maybe within capital markets or the exchange space, but relatively narrow in terms of where you saw creative development from a fintech perspective. And there was a lot of the sector that was extremely traditional back when we started up. So the asset management, the insurance sector, which is still largely very traditionally managed today, had not gone through this type of evolution. I think if you look at our investment strategy, if you take a look at our investment portfolio, going from our initial funds all the way through our current fund, which is our fifth fund, you'll see a similar evolution where we invested quite heavily in the asset management space in particular, which is a niche of ours, but then also a lot of the service providers into asset management. And then you saw us move into other segments, insurance, brokerage, et cetera. The last, I'd say, handful of years, we've been very focused on really finding businesses that have taken advantage of the technological development that you see amongst the fintech players. Many of the, I think it's difficult, Steve, for us to invest directly in early stage fintech companies. That's not our business. We're looking for firms that are established and profitable. But many of these established profitable firms, you know, have developed very capable, credible technology. We're looking for those firms that have a tech path forward and a tech-enabled plan, and not a more traditional plan of engaging with clients and customers, if you will.
So just kind of as a side note here, so LevelMedic has been focused on the financial sector for 20 years, started out of the banking business itself. And I don't know, would you say you're one of the earlier firms to sort of specialize? Because 20 years ago, there weren't most firms were sort of doing these general buyouts and across different industries, usually industrial or, you know, logistics or that kind of thing.
Exactly. So we were one of the very early entrants into the space. I noted the the Putnam Level connection, which was an investment bank focused, you know, purely in financial services and really just a couple of segments. Putnam Level did not really do M&A around the banking sector or the insurance underwriting sector. And if you look in our portfolio over the years, you see the same type of reflection. It's much more balance sheet light and more tech enabled. I'd say that focus that we've had for the last couple of decades has broadened where we've gone into other verticals inside financial services. But if we look around at the landscape, you do find, you know, just a handful of firms that are well known in the financial services space. You know, I'd contrast that with other areas where you see concentrated private equity investments being made or specialized private equity firms have been built. Tech would be another segment where there's dozens and dozens of firms that focus on tech. Healthcare is another one. Consumer is another one. Financial services, there's a handful of us. It's not as well trafficked, even though it's an extremely large segment, whether it's GDP or you look at the markets, whatever metric you take a look at. And we do think in our sector where many of the businesses are heavily regulated, you know, having a multi-decade level of experience in the sector is incredibly important to success in the space.
So just kind of along the theme of investment banks and big banks versus private equity firms, you were head of investment banking for more than a decade at Putnam Level. And did that connection lead you to LevelMedic in 2016?
It did, yes. So I spent, as you noted, kind of started in the mid-90s working with the founders of the Putnam Level business. Jeff Lovell and I have, you know, built a connection starting at that time. We spent a number of years working together in the investment banking side. And Jeff then founded the LevelMedic business in 99. And as you noted, I stayed on the investment banking side. We did keep in close touch. I think it was always our mutual hope that we would ultimately get back together again at some point. And that really came to fruition, as you noted, in 2016 when I rejoined the family, if you will.
So 2016, that's about 5 years, but you have a longer history with other people at the firm. So your track record is longer than that 5 years in some ways, right?
That is correct. So yeah. I've known, you know, most of my partners here at the firm since they started with the business, including my co-managing partner, Bob Belke, who's now been with LevelMedic, you know, approaching 20 years himself.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of your deals of late. You recently entered into an agreement to sell Foreside Financial, a compliance software company. Tell us about that company and a little bit about the sourcing maybe and what you did to grow the company and ultimately why you decided to sell it.
Sure. Yeah, happy to do that. So yes, as you noted, Foreside is a business and it's there's a theme I think you'll see in our portfolio today from a construction perspective where we'll get to know a sector, we'll dig underneath that sector in terms of who are some of the software suppliers or providers into that segment, and we'll go down another level. In the case of Foreside, they are a compliance platform that services large global asset managers. We actually got to know them through some of those early asset management investments that I referenced a while back. So going back to some of our early investments in Fund 1, Fund 2 in the asset management space, this was a name that kept popping up as a, you know, exceptional player in helping those asset managers kind of keep in bounds, if you will, from a compliance perspective as it relates to all the regulatory requirements and filings, et cetera. So with Foreside, actually one of my other partners out of our Philadelphia office, he was calling on the company for a number of years. We ended up, as you suggested, you know, investing in that business just over 4+ years ago. And then what I think you'll find a theme throughout, you know, call it roughly 80% of our portfolio, we assisted that team in doing a number of bolt-on transactions. So these are, you know, much smaller M&A transactions. Sometimes it's a team that's as small as just a handful of employees that you're bringing on board, really to fill out holes and gaps in your offering to your client base. We were able to do that quite a few times over the years. You know, Foreside was actually announcing deals as, you know, frequently as once a quarter when they were really ramping up. Asset business grew significantly and we started to see some inbound interest and did ultimately end up interviewing a handful of bankers. Earlier this year, engaging with a boutique firm to represent us, and that they then reached out and had a number of phone calls with interested parties, both a mix of strategics and sponsors who have expressed interest in what we call the GRC space, the governance, risk, and compliance space. And as you noted, we announced the deal recently, you know, very good outcome from our perspective. Can't go into the details of the returns, as you're aware, but very nice return for us and more importantly for our LPs.
I forget who the buyer was on that one.
It's a private equity firm out of the West Coast called Genstar, who we actually know pretty well.
Oh, Genstar.
Yeah, we've sold them businesses in the past. And, you know, we know they'll be a great owner of the business. The management team is really looking forward to partnering with Genstar. We've actually jointly owned a business with them in the past, a business called Mercer, that we sold with them a couple of years ago. Another you know, exceptional outcome. Great team there at Genstar. And I know they'll treat the Foreside team really well.
Yeah, I know the Mercer deal was something that I've covered a lot too. It's a very acquisitive company. So yeah, that's been out in the M&A world quite a bit. So one thing that private equity firms like to do is they like to carve out businesses from larger companies and then help them stand on their own and help them grow more quickly, because a lot of times there's these neglected businesses and larger companies that could use some love. And so Level Minic has a couple of deals like that.
In 2019, the firm carved out part of BluePay from First Data. Tell us about this and the art of the carve out.
Yeah, absolutely. We have done other corporate carve outs. Another one I'll flag is Center Square Investment Management, which was an asset manager that's a REIT manager that was part of the BNY Mellon asset management franchise. The BluePay business, Bill Highway, is one that we did carve out from, you know, what at that point had become a very large amalgamation of a number of previous substantial deals that were done in the payment space. Carve outs, you know, are very tricky. We look at a lot more than we execute, which is probably true of most of our peers. There's a few private equity firms that specialize in that area, and God bless them, they're tough to get done. You know, really, whether it's an accounting perspective or just negotiating with a large corporate owner, et cetera, they can be challenging deals to get done. But
yeah, sometimes you have to negotiate like service deals and something with the parent. You know, you've got, they might still like be handling some back office stuff that you got to contract from them and that kind of thing.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. So those transition services agreements can be, you know, sometimes more challenging than just negotiating a straight purchase agreement from a corporate seller or where you have a business that's not as integrated as some of these businesses are, you know, into the platform of the parent, if you will. So we don't do it often. We've had very good success when we have done it. You know, I would say you have to go into them being prepared for it to take materially longer than kind of an average transaction, but we'll continue to look at these opportunities whenever we come across them.
And how is the business you carved out, Bill Highway, performing?
Performing, you know, very well, kind of as expected. They do have a segment of their market that focuses on the college fraternal space. And so it did take a bit of a blip and a slowdown back this past fall when the students were not back on campus. And we look at that as a delay, but not a long-term concern. We certainly all hope and expect to have students back on campus in the fall and recover those lost revenues at that time. So all in all, business is doing very well. We actually executed on a nice bolt-on deal for them and, you know, really are looking forward to working with that management team over the coming years.
And then there's this FX trading platform called 1-0. That's another one that we've covered in the past. How's that one going?
1-0 is actually a minority investment. The bulk of what we do are control deals. In this case, we took a very sizable minority position, 1-0. They had no previous outside ownership. It was, you know, bootstrapped by the management team. That business is doing exceedingly well. We've done a number of things there. We actually went into that investment with an individual who I've known for a whole bunch of years and will probably be recognized by some of your listeners, Phil Weisberg, who was the CEO of a business called FXall. It was a portfolio company of TCV for a period of time, went public, and then was bought by Reuters, now Refinitiv. So Phil joined us in that investment and has ultimately actually decided to join the team. So he's full-time working at 1-0. He is responsible for building out the institutional side of the business. The core business there at 1-0 is providing white label software to primarily tier one, tier two retail banks and brokers. So it's a full suite of services in terms of FX software. They don't handle any of the trading. They don't face customers, but everything from kind of the trade on to regulatory reporting, they take care of in a white label fashion. So it's a software business, not a regulated entity. But Phil has been doing an exceptional job, as has this entire team, in building out the business in, you know, what's been a very volatile period for the past couple of years since we've been invested in it. Volatility, as you know, Steve, is good for exchanges. It's good for broker dealers who are the end clients of 1-0, and it's been good for 1-0. We have really been working hard to, I'd say, also transition our revenue model to have it look much more like a SaaS-driven revenue model. That's been going exceptionally well, building out our data businesses and our data products as well, and our analytics products. So a lot on their plate, but you know, just a tremendous management team. And we're seeing, you know, exceptional top-line growth with that business.
It's pretty interesting how Lovell Minnick touches so many different businesses with what you do. I mean, here you are with some business that operates an FX trading platform. And so, you know, I'm sure that FX trading platform was really active all during all this Brexit stuff the last couple of years. And so it's interesting how things are all kind of interlocked somehow.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
So you also sold Commercial Credit Group. That's an equipment financing company, to BDT in 2019. Could you talk about the sale process there? Were there multiple bidders? And can you provide any color on why the sellers chose BDT as a buyer, why you chose BDT as a buyer? And that's Byron Trott's firm. He's a billionaire ex-banker to, I guess, a guy by the name of Warren Buffett.
I think we've heard of him. So yes, Commercial Credit, a business that's in the commercial equipment finance space, based down in Charlotte, another really exceptional platform, a former platform company of ours in the portfolio. To answer a couple of your questions there, we did have a number of interested bidders. I'd say both sponsors as well as operators. Banks were interested in the platform as well, in terms of originating that type of paper. You know, I think BDT is a very interesting business in terms of, while it is thought of as a sponsor, they have a very long-term view, was my impression from those conversations with them. I will say this was another a very good return for us. Management had the ability to choose from multiple options here. And frankly, BDT just did a very nice job pitching to our management team, pitching to us. And one of the things that I think we appreciated about them as a buyer is that they all along did what they said they were going to do from the get-go. You know, we're really exceptional partners in terms of those discussions as they progressed. We like to think that we behave the same way, and we very much appreciated that. And so as far as I know, there's a very good relationship that continues to this day with BDT, and we wish them luck with that business.
Okay, great. Steve, talk about what got you interested in private equity after covering the financial institution space for major banks, as well as Putnam Lovell earlier on. You mentioned them earlier on. I guess you worked also at UBS and Credit Suisse.
Correct. Yeah, I have always spent my career kind of really coming out of undergrad, focused on financial services, worked for a bank in DC on the real estate lending front. That bank was actually a bank called Signet, not a name that's around today anymore, but one that people are very familiar with, their credit card line of business, which was spun out independently in the mid-90s and renamed Capital One. So I had the opportunity to watch, you know, that business be created inside the Signet Bank footprint. Actually, when I was banking early in my career for Salma Smith Barney, where I spent my summer, we actually had the mandate to work on that spin and that IPO. So got to see that from a different perspective. I will say, first and foremost, you know, my interest here is financial services. I had a, you know, strong desire to focus on M&A coming out of business school, which is why I chose to team up with the Putnam Lovell folks, which was a very small, I think I was the 12th employee when I joined in 95, very small platform, extremely boutique, you know, M&A shop at the time. Really, from there, never wavered in my interest in focusing on financial services and calling on and servicing financial service customers. I'd say one of the nice things about my time at Credit Suisse and UBS, where in both operations, I ended up running their financial institutions groups from a banking perspective, I also had the opportunity at each firm to sit on their investment committee for their balance sheet operations, where they invested into the financial technology space. So I moved from just an advisor to these players, and you're involved, you know, very episodically, as you might imagine. Typically, you have long-term relationship with your clients, but you're involved very episodically around a particular deal, and then you move on to the next deal. The nice thing about getting involved in the financial technology investing arms of both CS and UBS was be able to walk through, watch, see the process of putting money to work in the segment, and then how those firms were developed over many years. So that gave me, if you will, kind of the first taste of private equity. I will say, you know, beyond that, when you're in financial services, when you're in investment banking today, and for over the last decade, you know, the private equity world more broadly is a large client of the big investment banks. So they became, many of the firms that you know well and you've probably had on this show became clients of mine over the years. Got to see firsthand kind of how they operated as much as you can from the outside, which I found very intriguing. But you know, most importantly, these are small firms, Steve. You know, we're 40 people in total, 20 plus on the investment side. It's all about the people. It's all about your partners. It's all about, you know, who you spend your day with. And in this case, you know, having known, you know, Jeff Lovell since the mid 90s, knowing all the partners for almost that period of time, it was just a very natural fit. If I was going to move from a banking perspective into another industry, to come work with Jeff and with his partner, Jim Minnick as well. So I would say, you know, that's a long road to get there, but really about the people and about the space and the segment that we cover.
Okay, great. So one of the things we hear a lot about today is the frothy M&A environment. We did have some hiccups in the stock market this week, but things are back on again, it seems. Any advice you could share on how the firm manages to avoid overpaying, or is that even not possible nowadays? We've had some private equity folks on the show here talking about how you need to make your gains not on the purchase of the company, but more on what you do to improve it while you own it. I mean, he said you used to be able to just make money on the buy. You can't make money on the buy anymore. You have to fix the company up and improve it to make gains.
Spot on. I think I agree with those comments. I think, you know, if you think about private equity many years ago, there was less competition. Oftentimes put more leverage on the business. As long as you bought good businesses that were growing sufficiently with a fair amount of leverage, you know, you would generate a sufficient return. Or, you know, as they used to say back then, you know, set it and forget it. That's not private equity today. There's lots of different flavors of private equity, but you know, what I will tell you kind of across the board for the vast majority of us in this industry, we are extremely actively involved and I don't want to say the day-to-day, but certainly the week-to-week and month-to-month of the strategy and the management of these businesses from a board perspective, but a very active board perspective. To your question on pricing, you know, are multiples higher than they were a year ago or 2 years ago in most segments? Absolutely. That is the case. I think it's difficult to determine whether or not you're overpaying for something at close. You know, you'll know it in a few years. But if you're buying businesses that are growing rapidly, even if you're paying a large multiple, you certainly can earn your way into a very nice return. One of the ways I think we mitigate it and others that pursue the strategy, I've mentioned, you know, a couple of times, Steve, the strategy where we'll buy a platform company. Mercer was one that we talked about. Pathstone's another one that's doing exceptionally well in the portfolio today. And we have a host of others, certainly the Foresight business we talked about early on, very, very similar, where we will pay a fulsome multiple, if you will, for the platform. But then by acquiring much smaller businesses at hopefully significantly lower multiples, you're able to average down that multiple over time, if you will. And therefore, you really earn into a level of accretion, earn into your level of return, assuming the team is doing a nice job integrating those businesses. A lot of it is also just, you know, when do you choose to exit? What are the markets like in general? What are the public markets, the reference markets, and like when you go to exit? But you know, back to your core question. Pricing is certainly high, but I do think staying in your lanes, investing in businesses that you know well, backing management teams that you hopefully have known for years, potentially, like in the case of Foresight, or teams that you've really gotten to know over a period of time, if you have the opportunity to do so, you know, really allows you to mitigate those risks. And then through bolt-on M&A is one way. There's other ways, but one way we've been able to average down some of those frothy multiples.
Okay. Now, could you talk about any refinements in your sector focus nowadays? Is the firm interested in adding more talent from the technology and software businesses rather than the financial side of things because everything is so technology focused nowadays?
Yeah, great question. Very good observation there, Steve. So we have, I'd say, the core underlying business models that we invest in, you know, are still all about financial services. And while the delivery of the platform offerings, and one of the themes you might have picked up on throughout this entire conversation is we're very focused on businesses that focus on other businesses. We really don't have branded retail businesses where we invest. That's not where we've carved out our niche. These tend to be, you know, brands, if you will, that are not particularly well known in general. But I'd say one of the ways that we really try and mitigate this is we bring in experts from the outside that help us from a consulting perspective when we're getting up to speed on a platform, really to test the tech itself. Is the technology sufficient to support the growth plan that we're looking at and evaluating separately? We've also recently brought in an individual who's an operating partner who will assist us from the technology perspective. He's a former CTO of a software business. We haven't publicly announced this yet, so I'm not going to put his name out there. But
okay. I was wondering, did I miss the press release on that?
It's not out there yet. He has been exceptionally helpful in terms of both thinking through at the general partner level, is our technology up to snuff in terms of where it should be as a private equity firm? So where we are with this particular resource is, you know, someone that can help us evaluate upfront from a diligence perspective in a way that's, you know, multi-levels deeper than we would traditionally have gotten to, or most private equity investors would get to, around the quality of the offering, quality of technology, just to help us evaluate the CTO, for example, and we will plug him into all of these situations. The other way we will ask him to focus is on some of the cybersecurity concerns. Certainly the SEC, who regulates us, has told all private equity firms and all financial service firms, you know, get your act together around cybersecurity, particularly ransomware. You know, it's becoming more and more prevalent in general and across all industries, and just make sure that we're buttoned down. I think ransomware for most of us, it's not a matter of if, but when. And so let's make sure we've got a process in place to address it. And we do think that, you know, having his assistance and making sure we're up to snuff from that perspective has been greatly additive. But I do think, Steve, it's very rare that you're going to see us invest in businesses that don't have a heavy tech component in this day and age.
Sure, definitely. So, you know, talking about technology, most people think about the West Coast in terms of leading the way in technology and software, but the East Coast has led the way in fintech. Would you say that's true?
I think certainly, to my point on SME, you know, small, medium enterprise focused fintech, you know, business to business focused fintech, for sure. I think the West Coast does a really nice job with the large consumer facing brands. They've done a nice job on the lending front. They've done a nice job on some of the neobank front. But on, you know, what you'll see on the East Coast, you know, tends to be more nuts and bolts, plumbing, capital markets. A lot of those businesses get funded, you know, out of Silicon Alley, if you will, or out of some of the firms that are more traditionally private equity focused in Boston or New York or elsewhere. So I think we do a great job here. It is a different part of the world. It's probably less visible to the average consumer, but we certainly see a lot of flow in fintech and expect that to continue, despite us being based on primarily on the East Coast. We do have a LA location as well, Steve.
Okay, great. Yeah, LA is coming along as a technology area and a private equity area as well. It's come along. It's kind of below the radar, but it's definitely winning a lot of players and that kind of thing too. So LA is happening as well. So what's your deal pipeline starting to look like in 2022? Any economic indicators you're sort of watching closely? A lot of people have been worried about inflation. Super low interest rates have become the new normal. They've become the new normal. But what if they return to historic levels, for example? That's one, you know, one thing people are talking about.
Sure. Yeah. And I think you certainly would have different perspectives on this from different sponsors based upon, you know, how they manage their business and the construction of their portfolio. I think the pipeline for us and for many of my peers and other sponsors, if you go back to post-pandemic, you know, we had a number of months where it's as it should have been. We focused on family and, you know, the world around us, but it was very slow for, call it, a quarter and a half. We started seeing a number of distressed deals that popped up in the summer. That's not a space where we play. And then I would say that the more healthy flow of businesses came back to market in the fall, the winter, the spring, and it has not let up. You know, I was out to dinner with an investment banking friend of mine a couple of nights ago. He, like a lot of the other folks in the space, never been busier. We would say the same thing about our pipeline. You know, we track very closely in our CRM system. You know, how many deals are we looking at today versus a year ago versus the prior year? And just the number of looks that we've had, if you will, is up, you know, quite materially year over year, you know, to the point where almost double. And in this space, as you know, Steve, you're looking at, 20, 30, 40, 50 businesses before you find one that checks all the boxes for you. That doesn't mean there aren't a lot of great businesses that aren't going to do well. But in many cases, you need to find the cultural fit and management team that really sees eye to eye with you. And that takes a long time to sort through all these opportunities, and you need to understand the business model sufficiently. So pipeline looks very strong right now. New business initiatives, we run a single fund, I think, for the time being. Our current fifth fund is roughly 50% invested. So we have quite a bit of dry powder still left to go. And the fund itself is nothing currently in mind for us in terms of new business initiatives. Just keep doing what we've always done well. And hiring, again, small shop, there's never a lot of hiring needs. We do have a few younger associates, new associates that are, as they usually do, coming out of the investment banks, are going to be starting with us next month. And it's likely that you'll see us hire 3 to 4 associates each summer, like we've been doing the last couple of years, but no major changes. We certainly track inflation closely. We are not big consumers of debt. So you've heard some concerns in the marketplace about very cheap debt being put on, and could that negatively impact businesses in the future when rates start to rise? I mean, frankly, I think hopefully most people underwrote their cost to borrow at a much more normalized level. So that's one comment. We're not big consumers of leverage, though. So whether we're paying 500 basis points or 900 basis points for credit, it's not going to really impact the companies that we invest in because of the very low levels of leverage that we put on.
You guys use a lot of equity in your deals? You pay with a lot of equity usually?
We do. And we also quite often have management teams that are rolling equity alongside us. So if you think about funding the deal, it's usually a mix of our equity, oftentimes, LP co-invest, plus a few turns of debt, plus that management role. So it's not a need for us to have to push the envelope. Some of the business models we invest in, though, are levered to rates one way or the other. And in fact, frankly, for one of our portfolio companies, I'd love to see rates move up because we'd actually start to earn a spread again on one of our product lines. So I think it cuts both ways. We certainly hope that the Fed is able to slow down purchases, unwind balance sheet, slowly move up rates. I mean, that's easy to say, tough to execute on, and not more broadly disturb the economy. I think we're focused more on, I think, second order impact from rate movements than we are on rate movements themselves.
Okay. Well, Steve Pearson, managing partner at Lovelminick Partners. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it. Great to be here.
Thanks again. This is Steve Giudice, senior writer for The Deal. This has been Behind the Buyouts.